Hey, welcome to the 1505 Club. Today I'm going to talk to you about COVID and some of the things that we've learned over the last 3 years since it first kicked off, especially in regard to the vaccination. First off, I wanted to thank Dan Lyons for emailing me a study that became the impetus for this episode. So let's just dive in and begin with the study that he first sent to me. The study that Dr. Lyons sent me is entitled DNA Fragments Detected in Monovalent and Bivalent Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna modRNA COVID-19 Vaccines from Ontario, Canada. Exploratory Dose Response Relationship with Serious Adverse Events. The study was conducted by David J. Spiker, Jessica Rose, El Maria Gucci, David Wiseman, Kevin McKernan, Department of Pathobiology, University of Guelph, Ontario. There's a lot in this study that I'm not going to go into detail on, but that title tells you the punchline. So let's get straight to that part. From the conclusion, they state, quote, "These data demonstrate the presence of billions to hundreds of billions of DNA molecules per dose in these vaccines," end quote. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was in school, I was taught that injecting foreign DNA strands directly into your bloodstream would come with very grave results. Specifically, cancer. Now, I don't want you to take my word for it, so I thought I would ask ChatGPT and find out what common knowledge has to say. So I asked ChatGPT, what happens if you inject DNA into your bloodstream? The answer it gave me was this, quote, "Injecting DNA directly into the bloodstream is not recommended or a safe practice. DNA is typically introduced into cells through more controlled methods, such as gene therapy, under strict medical supervision. Injecting DNA directly could lead to unintended consequences and health risks," end quote. While it's not a smoking gun, it was still more than I thought they would admit. In reality, the only way that foreign DNA is introduced into the body is with gene therapy, which we'll talk about more in just a little bit. The point is, injecting DNA into the bloodstream is never going to be productive and it will always be negative. Nobody would ever do it on purpose, and would have to be considered highly unethical to inject it into someone else's bloodstream without their knowledge. Which apparently, according to the study, is exactly what's been happening. Based on this, I was curious to know if there was an increase in the current cancer rates. Going to the CDC website, I found the following statement, quote, "In the United States, in 2020, 1,603,844 new cancer cases were reported, and 602,347 people died of cancer. For every 1,000 people, 403 new cancer cases were reported, and 144 people died of cancer. 2020 is the latest year for which incidence data are available," end quote. So this is pretty convenient. If we don't yet know what happened after 2020, then we don't have any way of knowing if any COVID vaccine has ever led to an identifiable increase in cancer. However, I do think it's a pretty logical guess that it did, knowing the vaccine contains such high numbers of DNA fragments that were being injected into people's bloodstreams. A few years back, I believe it was before COVID, on GreenMedInfo, Sayer G posted a study that was done to look at the purity of vaccines. A guy was doing a study as a requirement for his graduate degree. In that study, he was to look and see how many things he could find in a simple vaccine that should not be there. The interesting part is that for his control, he chose to use veterinary vaccines. What he did not expect to find was that the veterinary vaccines were completely pure. He found nothing in them that was not supposed to be there. At first, he was baffled by that. But then he quickly realized that the difference between the two vaccines is that if your dog gets a vaccine and dies, you can technically sue. But if your child gets a vaccine and dies, you cannot sue them. This researcher then contacted the human vaccine manufacturer and suggested that he could help them clean the impurities out of their vaccine. Their response was essentially, "Go away. We don't care. All you could possibly do is raise our costs since we can't be sued anyway." I tell you that because knowing that second story is what made me unsurprised and somewhat validated when I heard the first story. I'm not the least bit surprised that the COVID vaccine is filled with random DNA debris. There was another remarkable study that I recently heard about that demonstrated that post-COVID vaccination, the heart stops using fat as its primary energy source, that is normal physiology, and instead relies on carbohydrates as its primary fuel source. When I mentioned this to my wife, she said, "Then I guess a keto diet probably isn't a very good idea for someone who's got the jab. How come nobody's telling them that?" I said, I'd be shocked if there were any doctors who even know that that's a thing, and you can't share what you don't know. To that end, I found another study by Masaki Moji in the journal Hypertension Research. In this study, they were looking for endothelial damage post-COVID vaccine. What they found was, quote, caused a marked increase in inflammatory markers and deterioration of endothelial function. However, these changes were temporary, with a peak at 1 day after vaccination and had recovered to baseline at 2 days after vaccination. Thus, they concluded the short-term cardiovascular safety of the vaccine. End quote. Okay, so first of all, most of the deaths occur within 48 hours of vaccination, but then you can always pull the trick of hiding the details in the average. By looking at the 2 week period following vaccination, you can say that there's no difference in death rate in the first 2 days than there is in the 13th and 14th day. Therefore, there's no elevated risk and we can surmise that the vaccine is safe. But what if the vaccine is killing just as many people in the 13th and 14th day as it did in the first two? This is the science trick invented by Anthony Fauci, whereby you can take something very deadly and, quote, scientifically proven, that it's totally safe, and that's exactly what he did with remdesivir. If I could editorialize just a little bit here, it seems evident to me that the spike protein does damage to the endothelium of the heart. It does not matter whether you acquire the spike protein naturally, by wild virus, or by vaccination. Your body doesn't care. What matters is that the spike protein always does damage. At the same time, if I know that ricin can kill me, then I'm going to try to avoid it in my food. But I'm certainly not going to inject it into my bloodstream, thinking it'll somehow boost my immune system so that I can't be injured by ricin. The human-engineered spike protein is a poison, no less than ricin, even though it might take a little longer to do its deed. And it makes no sense to inject toxin into your bloodstream because it cannot boost your immune system, it can only overwhelm it. So, what was the real goal here? The real goal was never to create immunity, well, except to create immunity for the manufacturers, but not for the recipients. The goal was to do experiments in gene therapy on an unsuspecting population under the guise and the immunity of calling it a vaccine, but knowing all the time that it's not. It only took a little bit of digging for me to confirm that they have been using snake venom in gene therapy for roughly 40 years. In other words, this is not a new thing. It took me a little more effort to discover the reason why. The unique thing about snake venom is that anything they create that has the ability to unlock or unzip the DNA will also destroy any peptides or genetic information that they then intend to insert. Snake venom has the unique ability to unlock the DNA while preserving the peptides it contains. Since they've never been able to effectively duplicate or synthesize a replacement for snake venom, the only alternative is to use actual snake venom and capitalize on its unique ability. A study from the University of Arizona looked at the spike protein contained in the vaccine, which, by the way, I've seen in the literature that whenever they're looking at the spike protein microscopically, they draw a distinction between wild spike protein and vaccine spike protein, although I've not yet found any details about what creates an observable difference between the two. Anyway, the University of Arizona found, when they analyzed the spike protein, that it contained both snake venom and venom from sea cones found deep beneath the surface of the ocean, where no human would ever interact with them except on purpose. All that to say, it's now clear that the mRNA vaccine is not a vaccine at all, but it's an experimental form of an all-in-one gene therapy, meaning the spike protein contains the snake venom and the DNA, so instead of requiring different steps, it's a simple one-dose administration. Of course, the justification is that they're doing minor gene therapy to create immunity against COVID. The problem is that any immunity seems to be short-lived, so that subsequent vaccines produce less benefit and for a shorter amount of time, while the consequences and side effects become more severe over time. Now here's the part that I think is relevant for us as chiropractors. Lately, over the last few months, I've noticed more and more patients with severe sciatica with no discernible evidence of subluxation in the low back or pelvis. I began to wonder if this could be a consequence of COVID, so I went to the literature to see what I could find. Lo and behold, I immediately found the confirmation I was looking for. Yes, there are case reports involving COVID-induced sciatica, although it's not clear if these cases were the result of the wild COVID or the vaccine, as some cases tested positive for COVID, but the majority did not. More importantly, as investigators took a closer look, what they discovered was that the sciatica pain was caused by demyelination of the spinal cord. It's also not immediately obvious that this demyelination is self-limiting or reversible. Some of the case reports included the MRI, and it was clear that the patient did not have thecal sac pressure, nor were any of the discs to blame. Speaking of unintended consequences, Science magazine has an article about how the mRNA in the vaccine causes a quarter of the people who get the vaccine to create transcription errors, leading to the creation of many unintended proteins. Never fear, they say, this is actually a good thing. Why? Because it allows scientists to gain valuable knowledge about how mRNA technology works in the human body so they can create better vaccines in the future. In other words, they just admitted that they conducted an enormous experiment with unknowing test subjects that they did not have to pay, no IRB approval, and no liability. How do you increase the profitability of a new drug? Conduct experiments for free. Better yet, get the government to pay while you conduct the experiments for free. It's pretty clear that little was known about how mRNA gene therapy would act inside the body. They now admit that they know a whole lot more and will make changes in the future based on what they've learned. So here's an interesting thing that I discovered on the Mayo Clinic's website. In an article attributed to Mayo Clinic staff, they acknowledge that there's a difference between sudden cardiac arrest and sudden cardiac death. Sudden cardiac arrest is a loss of heart activity due to an irregular heart rhythm. This problem can be helped with CPR or an AED, and survival is possible. Sudden cardiac death, on the other hand, is sudden death of the heart, where CPR and other life-saving measures are of no use because the patient is already dead. What we're seeing with people suddenly dying, sometimes during or after physical exertion, and sometimes not, appears to be a combination of both sudden cardiac arrest and sudden cardiac death, whereby some patients are kept alive and resuscitated with life-saving measures, and others are just simply dead. At this point, there's no counter-argument to the fact that Americans are dying at a faster rate than before, with the number of excess deaths, that is, the number of deaths in excess to the number of expected deaths for a given year, nearly doubling. Let me give you some hard numbers. In 2021, more than 892,000 of the 3,456,000 deaths the U.S. experienced, or about 1 in 4, was an excess death. In 2019, that number was merely 483,000, or nearly 1 in 6. That represents an 84.9% increase in excess deaths in the United States between 2019 and 2021. The question everybody has is the question of what is causing all of these excess deaths. In reality, it's unlikely that it's just one thing. There's no doubt that more people are dying suddenly, both in their sleep and when they're awake, of heart-related issues, including cardiomyopathy. However, this fact is easily obscured by the fact that the U.S. has higher obesity rates than similar countries in Europe that have higher life expectancy. Also, the U.S. has higher death rates from homicide than similar countries in Europe. Looking at the source of violence seems to indicate that homicides of this nature have less to do with the ease of obtaining a weapon and more to do with a culture that celebrates violence, getting your way through force, and living a lifestyle without consequences. But I digress. Another major cause of death in the U.S., which no longer gets the press it once did, is the fentanyl epidemic, which claims lives every day, most of whom are younger and therefore have a tremendous effect on life expectancy numbers. More people have died of synthetic opioid overdoses than the number of U.S. military personnel killed during the Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan wars combined. Fentanyl is now the leading cause of death for Americans ages 18 to 49. It takes about 2 milligrams of fentanyl to overdose. The opioid is 50 times more potent than heroin. According to Brigham Bueller, who has recently been on Joe Rogan and RFK Jr.'s podcast, the reason for the fentanyl epidemic is because insurance companies paid for opioids, which caused doctors to prescribe opioids to get paid. Millions of people got addicted to opioids, and then the insurance industry suddenly stopped paying for them, and the doctors stopped prescribing them. This leaves people with one of two options. Admit you have a problem and you're an addict and endure the social stigma of entering a detox program, or go to the black market and use fentanyl to hide your addiction. Along with this is the fact that U.S. suicide rates are currently the highest that they've been in 80 years. Once again, here are the hard numbers. Suicide rates increased approximately 36% between 2000 and 2021. Suicide was responsible for 48,183 deaths in 2021, which is about one death every 11 minutes. The number of people who think about or attempt suicide is even higher. In 2021, an estimated 12.3 million American adults seriously thought about suicide. 3.5 million planned a suicide attempt, and 1.7 million attempted suicide. Suicide affects people of all ages, In 2021, suicide was among the top 9 leading causes of death for people ages 10 to 64. Suicide was the second leading cause of death for people ages 10 to 14 and 20 to 34.3. I hate to go there again, but once again, this sounds like a cultural problem. Never underestimate the power of culture and a cultural problem of this magnitude. Now, the reason why I took the time to go through all of those is because when something is multifactorial, it tends to have the effect that people blame nothing that contributes instead of blaming everything that contributes. For example, I just saw a story on Facebook regarding a man in his late 30s who just died suddenly. The person who posted it said simply, "Why does this keep happening?" I immediately went to the comments to see if I would find what I suspected I would. Of course I did. I found person after person who commented that nothing is out of the ordinary. These young people have always died suddenly, but now it gets more press. I think this is particularly damaging because I've just shown you that there are excess deaths. The spike protein, whether wild or vaccine, does cause damage to the heart, and some people experience sudden cardiac death and can't be revived. The major difference is that sudden cardiac death was once rare, and it was extremely rare in people under 39 years of age. Sudden cardiac death is certainly increasing across all age groups, even though the government agencies aren't releasing the numbers since COVID began. We still know it's true because we can see the rise in other numbers, like excess death rates and a declining life expectancy rate, and that's not a good thing. Okay, so we've talked about all the death and how rates are going up and life expectancy is going down, at least in the US. But what about all the people who live but are permanently damaged because of the spike protein? The Epoch Times just recently reported on a study that's gotten no attention, whereby they were able to demonstrate that giving the COVID vaccine to pregnant rats at the midway of their gestation point caused the offspring to have autism. Investigating further to determine the cause of this autism, they found it was due to a decreased number of neurons in the brains of these rat offspring. It's kind of challenging to say this, but that is not a typical form of autism. So even though they're calling it autism, this is not a high-functioning autism, but more like a severe mental handicap. While it's unethical to conduct these same studies on humans, the results would most likely translate to humans as well. The Epoch Times points out that the FDA still says that it's perfectly safe for pregnant women to get vaccinated during pregnancy, even though the minute amount of evidence we have seems to indicate the exact opposite. So we have a study by Vahe Nafilian et al. And published in the journal Nature Communications, article number 1541. In this study, they looked at risk of death following COVID-19 vaccination or positive SARS-CoV-2 test in young people in England. That's the title of the study. What I found interesting with this study was not their results, but some of their commentary about those results. Simply put, their results showed, quote, "Subgroup analyses by vaccine vectors were generally consistent with the main results. However, for non-mRNA or unknown vaccine vectors, primarily consisting of the Oxford AstraZeneca, for the first dose and all doses combined, there were significant increases in the incidence of cardiac death. A raised risk of all-cause hospital death was observed after a first dose of a non-mRNA vaccine, but this was not seen in all-cause registered deaths. Subgroup analysis, stratified by age, group, and sex, were consistent with the main results except after the first dose in females, in which cardiac death was increased. This corresponded to one additional cardiac registered death for every 363,419 females aged 12 to 29 who were vaccinated." End quote. Along with that, they also found an increased risk of cardiac death in those who tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 but were unvaccinated. Again, this seems to implicate the presence of spike protein as the risk for cardiac death, regardless of how it got there. Now here's some of the commentary that I found interesting. Quote, "We found evidence of an increase in the risk of all-cause and cardiac death after a first dose of a non-mRNA-based vaccine among females, and some evidence of a smaller increase after a second dose of an mRNA vaccine in males." End quote. What they're saying is that an mRNA vaccine is more likely to produce cardiac damage in males, and a non-mRNA vaccine is more likely to produce cardiac damage in females. The authors went on to say, quote, "People who are clinically extremely vulnerable may be at greater risk of adverse events following vaccination than the general population. In our study population, 52% of people who received a first vaccine before April 7, 2021 received a non-mRNA or unknown vaccine compared to 4.3% of people who received a first vaccine on or after April 7, 2021. By contrast, we observed an increase in the risk of cardiac and all-cause mortality after a positive SARS-CoV-2 test among both unvaccinated and vaccinated individuals. Results were robust to extending the length of the risk period, end quote. Again, this seems to indicate that spike protein always does damage, and whether you inhaled the wild type or you inject the vaccine type, the end result is that spike protein does damage to the heart. Why would you want to use mRNA gene therapy to turn your cells into a spike protein generating factory if those spike proteins are going to damage the endothelial lining of your heart, which we have clear evidence that they do? It's also worth noting that one of the author's arguments is that sick people are more likely to get vaccines. Therefore, when they have adverse consequences of the vaccine or they die, then this should not be blamed on the vaccine, but more on the fact that they were so sick to begin with. Finally, here's one more excerpt from the discussion that I found interesting. Quote, a recent analysis of data from Florida, the United States, found increased risk of cardiac death in the first 4 weeks after mRNA vaccination in people aged 18 to 39 years, compared to subsequent weeks. The Florida study used an SCCS approach, but did not account for multiple exposure. Instead, they combined deaths after first and second doses while extending follow-up beyond the interval between doses, which introduced bias. Similarly, excluding patients based on any post-vaccination event, a booster dose, or positive test for SARS-CoV-2 would have also biased the vaccination results. A further distinction between the U.S.-based study and our current publication is the vaccination type. This is the important part. In our study, mRNA vaccination primarily represents the BNT162b2 Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and non-mRNA vaccination, the CHADOX1 Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, whereas in the U.S., mRNA vaccination represents a larger population of the mRNA 1273 Moderna vaccine, and the non-mRNA primarily represents the AD26.COV2.S Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and that dosing intervals were shorter in the USA compared to the UK. In simple English, they're simply saying that the results of the two studies may not be comparable because the mRNA vaccine and non-mRNA vaccines that they used were different brands from different manufacturers. Also, the US gives their vaccines closer together, and the UK gives more time in between doses, and that could also contribute to a different result. I think logic dictates it probably would. This got my attention because I think your average Joe vaccinated person doesn't think there are any differences between the manufacturers, nor do they think the time interval between doses is of any importance at all. When you look at the results of the Florida study, I would say that the results of the UK study are bad, and the results of the Florida study are even worse. Logic would dictate that if you know you're using something that's potentially harmful, you'd want to use it in the least harmful way possible. It doesn't do any good to lie about what that is and do dangerous things while telling people it's totally safe, unless your only goal is to make as much money as possible and as quickly as possible. There's also a troubling thought process about how some of this data is being interpreted. Let me read you the entire abstract from a study by Yuta Tani et al. Entitled, Five Doses of the mRNA Vaccination Potentially Suppress Ancestral Strain-Stimulated SARS-CoV-2 Specific Cellular Immunity, a cohort study from the Fukushima Vaccination Community Survey, Japan. With this one, I want you to listen closely to the data, but then catch their editorialized conclusion at the end. Quote, the bivalent mRNA vaccine is recommended to address coronavirus disease variants, with additional doses suggested for high-risk groups. However, the effectiveness, optimal frequency, and number of doses remain uncertain. In this study, we examined the long-term cellular and humoral immune responses following the fifth administration of the mRNA severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 vaccine in patients undergoing hemodialysis. To our knowledge, this is the first study to monitor long-term data on humoral and cellular immunity dynamics in high-risk populations after five doses of mRNA vaccination, including the bivalent mRNA vaccine. Whereas most patients maintained humoral immunity throughout the observation period, we observed reduced cellular immune reactivity as measured by the ancestral strain-stimulated ELISpot assay in a subset of patients. Half of the individuals, 50%, it was exactly 14 out of 28, maintained cellular immunity 3 months after the fifth dose, despite acquiring humoral immunity. The absence of a relationship between positive controls and T-spot reactivity suggests that these immune alterations were specific to SARS-CoV-2. In multivariable analysis, Participants aged greater than 70 years showed a marginally significant lower likelihood of having reactive results. Notably, among the 14 individuals who received heterologous vaccines, 13 successfully acquired cellular immunity, supporting the effectiveness of this administration's strategy. These findings provide valuable insights for future vaccination strategies in vulnerable populations. However, further research is needed to evaluate the involvement of immune tolerance and exhaustion through repeated vaccination to optimize immunization strategies, end quote. This study clearly showed that as humoral immunity was increased, there was a corresponding decrease in cellular immunity, and that for people over 70, it was less likely that they would develop humoral immunity as they were losing their cellular immunity. That sounds like a huge red flag to me, but they concluded that since almost all the people who got heterologous vaccines acquired cellular immunity, then this is the way to go. People who understand the immune system understand that we have two parts for a reason, and the most healthy people are the ones who have flexibility and adaptability to move between the two. Forcing the immune system in one direction or the other might sound good on paper, but it does not produce healthy people the way that we would want it to. Simply driving an increase in humoral or cellular immunity is not an indication that you're healthier, and even though it might prevent you or at least decrease your odds of getting a particular disease, it does so at the expense of opening the door to a whole host of other problems, especially chronic diseases. The truth is, we could possibly continue to go down this road for a very long time, but instead of doing that, let me conclude by talking briefly about how we got here. According to RFK Jr., the vaccine industry and the bioweapons industry are one and the same. The reason why is that gain-of-function research has been done under the auspices of trying to create safer and more effective vaccines. Now, I don't know that anyone could prove that the vaccines are actually safer or more effective, but it's clear that gain-of-function research has led to the creation of some pretty powerful diseases that never would have happened naturally. Diseases like COVID, but also Lyme disease and West Nile virus. That one was the result of gain-of-function research on Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Basically, they say that doing this gain-of-function research will give them a head start on developing vaccines for emerging diseases. However, what we've mostly received is viral monstrosities that never could have been created by natural means alone. In the end, the most important thing to know is that the spike protein is the cause of most of the problems and the deaths that we see. Whether we acquire the spike protein by natural means or by injection, the consequence is always negative because the body has no natural mechanism for fighting the spike protein. That's why it's reported that 500,000 people died in the U.S. from COVID. So the other important thing to know is that the combination of quercetin and zinc is the cheapest way to destroy the spike protein once it is inside the cell. Let me briefly conclude with a look ahead to the future. If you haven't heard about it yet, they're calling it Disease X. The World Health Organization refers to any disease that could cause the next pandemic as Disease X. In rats, this disease turned their eyes solid white so they look like zombies. More importantly, the lethality of the disease was 100%. Every single one of the rats died. At this point, we know very little about Disease X, but I think we know a few things. I'd be willing to bet that it's the result of gain-of-function research. I'd also bet that they have a vaccine waiting in the wings to be rolled out as soon as it emerges. I'd also bet that that vaccine will be less effective than what they will tell people it'll be. Call it Free Gene Therapy Research Part 2. Thank you for joining me today. I hope this has armed you with some helpful information, and I hope it's helped to piece together some seemingly random pieces of information. I can assure you that if any other pandemics emerge, I'll revisit this topic and give you what you need to know. Until then, I hope you have the very best week possible, and I'll see you again next time. Thank you.